All right, good morning. We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, May 10, 2018, to consider the matters entitled Secretary of Labor versus the American Coal Company, docket number Lake 2011-13. President or myself, acting Chairman Alton, Commissioner Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Cohen. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Sarah Stewart. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, acting Chairman and Commissioners. This case is before the Commission on interlocutory review for a second time. At issue is whether the judge applied an incorrect legal standard in denying the Secretary of Labor's amended motion to approve settlement. This case involves...
Talk a little slower.
Oh, sure. And louder? Okay. This case involves 32 contested citations issued to American Coal in 2010. In 2013, the Secretary filed a motion to approve settlement that involved a 30% across-the-board penalty reduction for each citation. The judge issued a decision denying the motion because the motion had failed to provide adequate factual support for the penalty reduction. The Commission reviewed the judge's decision on interlocutory review and, in August of 2016, issued a decision affirming the judge's denial. As relevant to the subject appeal, the Commission concluded that under Section 110K of the Mine Act, the Commission has the exclusive responsibility for approving all proposed settlements of contested civil penalties, and that in effectuating this congressional mandate, the Commission and its judges consider whether the settlement of a proposed penalty is fair, reasonable, appropriate under the facts, and protects the public interest. The Commission further stated that through its procedural rules, the Commission has required parties to submit facts supporting a penalty reduction. Standards for such factual support may be found in Section 110I of the Mine Act, but the Commission also stated that the parties may submit facts supporting a settlement that fall outside of the Section 110I factors. It also held that uniform penalty reductions are not improper per se. The Secretary filed a petition for review with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and later withdrew that appeal. In March 2017, the Secretary submitted an amended motion to approve settlement to the judge. In the motion, the Secretary provided additional information, including in part the following: that the Secretary's counsel reviewed the entire case, including privileged information that would be improper or imprudent to share with the court and opposing counsel concerning the evidence developed in the case; that counsel concluded that there was a substantial risk that the court could reduce the degree of negligence or gravity with respect to 14 of the 32 citations; that one additional citation ran the risk of being vacated because the Secretary and the operator had a legal dispute about the standard cited; that after trial, if each of the citations that were at risk received a worst-case outcome, the resulting penalties would reflect an approximately 50% reduction from the penalties originally proposed by the Secretary, and that the Secretary concluded that an across-the-board 30% penalty reduction was an appropriate compromise; and finally, that the Secretary considered the fact that the proposed penalty preserves all of the citations as written to be a significant advantage and advances the purpose of the Act. On May 2, 2017, the judge issued an order denying the Secretary's motion. The judge stated that the essential problem with the Secretary's latest motion was that it did not provide a penalty factor-related explanation to support the uniform 30% reduction for each citation. The Secretary subsequently sought interlocutory review of the judge's denial. On May 19, 2017, the judge issued an order denying the Secretary's motion for interlocutory review. The judge reiterated that a one-size-fits-all 30% reduction is not likely to be satisfactory because each violation is fact-specific. The judge emphasized that the facts required are facts about the alleged violations. The judge also explained that only legitimate disputes of fact are usually sufficient to support a proposed reduction. The Secretary filed a petition for interlocutory review with the Commission, and AMCOL joined that petition, and the Commission granted interlocutory review. On review, the Secretary argues that the judge applied an erroneous legal standard in concluding that the Secretary failed to provide facts in support of the proposed settlement. He submits that such facts are not limited to facts related to the Section 110I penalty criteria or to the alleged violations. The Secretary further argues that the Commission Procedural 31 does not preclude a settlement of multiple penalties for a uniform percentage reduction for each penalty, and that the judge's denial makes such reductions impermissible de facto. AMCO also argues that the judge applied an erroneous legal standard in reviewing the proposed settlement. It asserts that judges must consider detailed procedural facts if presented, as they were here, and that a judge cannot require only substantive facts relating to the Section 110I criteria. AMCO further contends that the Commission should continue to support settlements that propose global uniform penalty reductions, like the settlement here, and that the Commission should not require a settling party to concede legitimate questions of fact during the settlement approval process, as the judge required. The intervener unions respond that the judge's order should be affirmed as a proper exercise of discretion. It asserts, in part, that the judge's order does not limit the acceptable factual showing to the Section 110I criteria, and that the judge considered the conclusory statements made by the Secretary but correctly determined that they were not sufficient to warrant approving the settlement. They also contend that while a set of extraordinary facts, like those present in the December 2010 ARACOMA decision, may be deemed sufficient on their own to support settlement approval, the Secretary has offered no such facts in this case. So the question on review is whether the judge applied an incorrect legal standard in denying the Secretary's March 29, 2017 motion to approve settlement. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for that good presentation. Are there any questions for Ms. Stewart? None? Okay. Commissioner Jordan has agreed to go first today.
Thank you, Chairman Alton, and thank you, Sarah, for your very thorough memo and summation. I think that this case has obviously had a long and kind of tortured history, but perhaps because the issue of whether to approve a settlement is something that I believe the judges have a lot of flexibility and wide discretion, and it's maybe difficult to walk the fine line that is required of them to obtain enough information to reassure themselves that the settlement is fair and reasonable and appropriate under the facts and serves the public interest, which is the standard that the Commission has advised should be applied, to get enough information to reassure themselves that that is sufficient for them to approve a settlement, and on the other hand, not perhaps acting, you know, overreaching too far, or so that they're inserting themselves too much in the process and perhaps requiring information, as the parties have indicated, which might be problematic should the case not settle and the judge has to adjudicate the matter. But bearing that in mind, I do feel that although Judge Moran, in perhaps trying to be conscientious, and did go astray, did err in different aspects in his review of this settlement proposal. For one thing, I think he focused very much on wanting to apply the statutory criteria for penalty assessment, but I think it was in a very rigid manner here, overly rigid. Although he gave verbal agreement to the Commission's ruling that global settlements are not, you know, are allowed and are not per se a problem. In fact, his discussion in the decision really seemed to indicate that he really was expecting and demanding that each of the 32 citations that he be provided with information that would discuss each of the statutory criteria vis-a-vis those violations. And that really, I think as some of the parties' briefs have pointed out, it might not in theory preclude the kind of across-the-board global settlements that the commission has said are okay, but in reality, in de facto, I think it would make it very problematic. And on the one hand, besides looking for certain information and criticizing the parties for not providing certain information before him, he excluded other information that the parties were seeking to put before him. And I think he erred in that regard. I mean, I think it was error for him to discount the fact, as the parties, well, at least the operating secretary, were pointing out to him that, and in argument, even intervening union conceded, that it is a factor to consider, an appropriate factor that weighs in favor of, you know, looking at a settlement favorably, to the fact that the operator was conceding, admitting all of the violations and admitting all of the special findings that were attached to those violations. And the secretary had pointed out that that was a positive factor that would influence enforcement proceedings down the road, and that, you know, the judge discounted that. At the same time, although the judge was indicating his disappointment or disapproval that he had not been provided with specific facts that would show how each of the statutory criteria applied, he rejected the offer that the operator made to submit to him a prepared statement that the operator had prepared to contend to the secretary that, in fact, the proceeding, that the violations warranted like a, you know, 60-something reduction. And I think it was an error for the judge to say that, on the one hand, to reject the settlement for lack of certain facts, on the other hand, to reject that submission. I feel that given these errors, that I would vacate the judge's rejection of the settlement. And I think he erred in rejecting the settlement on these grounds that warrant vacating his ruling. I pondered what action to take given that. I mean, it would either be remanding it back to him. I considered whether there was sufficient information to approve the settlement up here, especially given the long, torturous history of the case. But I think, in thinking about it, I lean towards remanding it to the judge, back to Judge Moran. And specifying for him to reevaluate the settlement in light of the points that I made, you know, advising him of corrections to be made in his review of the settlement.
Thank you, Commissioner Jordan. Commissioner Cohen. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Sarah, for a very good memo and for working with us, and she will continue to do. I think in looking at this case, you got to start with certain fundamentals. First, Section 110K is unique in explicitly providing the Commission with authority to approve settlement. Second, legislative history shows Congress's concerns with the enforcement agency, then MESA, but we're now dealing with MSHA, settling too cheaply, thus reducing the effectiveness of the civil penalty. And Congress was concerned about the lack of public scrutiny of settlements. And Congress explicitly gave the Commission the authority to protect the public interest in evaluating settlements, proposed settlements. Third, as we pointed out in the American Coal decision we issued in August 2016, the legislative history sets Commission approval of proposed settlements by the Secretary apart from situations such as approval of consent decrees by courts where there is no substantive review of the proposed settlement. In other words, our settlement review authority is generally broader than what is encountered in other situations where courts or administrative agencies review settlements. Fourth, we held in the first American Coal decision that, quote, a judge must have information sufficient to carry out the Commission's responsibility under Section 110K. Parties are required to provide facts in support of a penalty agreed to in settlement by Commission's rule, procedural rule 31B1. Fifth fundamental fact is that the Secretary does not accept the Commission's authority to substantively review his settlements. The record contains the May 2, 2014 memorandum from the Associate Solicitor for Mine Safety and Health, which identifies this American Coal case as the test case by which the Secretary will challenge the Commission's authority. The memorandum states the Secretary's position in no uncertain terms, quote, the Commission's role should simply be to confirm the clarity and enforceability of the agreement as submitted. That's the Secretary's position. Mr. Waldman said yesterday that the Secretary accepted the Commission's decision in the first American Coal case, but when pressed further, he acknowledged that their acceptance is only a recognition of the law of the case doctrine applicable solely during the remand phase of this case. The Secretary reserves the right to challenge the first American Coal decision, and I strongly suspect that in withdrawing the appeal of the first American Coal decision, the Secretary was following a strategy of attempting to make his case stronger and then seeking to challenge the decision again. Now, after we issued the first American Coal decision, the Secretary filed a second settlement motion, seeking the same across-the-board 30% reduction in the 32 penalties at issue. The Secretary dressed up his new motion in a couple of ways. Well, four ways that I'm going to describe. First, the Secretary represented that he had reviewed all 32 citations and concluded that A, there was substantial risk that the judge would reduce negligence or gravity in 14 of the 32 citations. B, in an additional citation, there was a risk of the citation being vacated. And C, in a worst-case scenario, assuming that everything went bad, the Part 100 penalty tables would indicate an approximately 50% reduction from the penalties as proposed. Second, the Secretary represented that the across-the-board reduction by 30% preserved all of the citations as written, which would assist the Secretary in future enforcement efforts against this operator. Third, the Secretary recited that he had given no weight to the costs of going to trial, but then said he was, quote, maximizing his prosecutorial impact, unquote, in settling this case while litigating others. The distinction between maximizing one's prosecutorial impact and weighing the costs of going to trial, you know, I do not understand what distinction they're trying to make there, because it sounds the same to me. Fourth, the Secretary included a considerable amount of what is essentially boilerplate applicable to any settlement motion about the difficulties involved in getting the operator to settle the case. Now, in his order denying settlement issued on May 2, 2017, and again in his order denying the Secretary's motion to certify the May 2 order for interlocutory review, Judge Moran again rejected the settlement. He could have done it in a very simple fashion by pointing out that the Secretary had not provided any substantive facts about the citations themselves. When I say substantive facts, I'm referring to, I'm using the American Coal distinction here, facts that were alleged in each citation by the MSHA inspector and what counterfacts the operator expected to prove which would have the effect of voiding the citation or reducing the alleged negligence or gravity. This is the information which is placed in settlement motions before the Commission on a regular basis. In the oral argument yesterday, the Secretary's counsel did not dispute Commission statistics that from fiscal year 2015 through the first 7 months of fiscal year 2018, Commission judges had approved 99.83% of proposed settlements. There was discussion about this figure, including some cases where judges had asked for more information and then approved the proposed settlements, but that does not matter. The fact remains that in 99.83% of the proposed settlements, the Secretary, either initially or at the subsequent request of the judge, had supplied substantive information about the particular citation justifying settlement of the penalty, and that this information was sufficient to convince the judge to approve the proposed settlement. In the group of cases we are reviewing here, however, the Secretary did not furnish that type of information. It's very interesting, I think, that American Coal offered to provide that information. Yesterday, Mr. Hardin suggested that the Secretary did not provide the information himself because this is indeed a test case. I think his suggestion is spot on. The Secretary did not provide substantive information about the specific citations because he continues to see this case as a way to challenge the Commission's authority to require such information. If Judge Moran had simply rejected the settlement motion because of the total absence of substantive facts about the citations, I think that this would be a pretty easy decision to affirm. But Judge Moran chose not to handle it that way. Instead, he did two things which have greatly complicated the case for the Commission. First, he inserted into his two decisions, particularly the second decision, some legal opinions which are highly questionable. He said, for example, that the disputed facts supporting the settlement must be tied to the Mine Act Section 110I factors for assessing penalties, and that the Secretary had presented no facts, whatever, in support of the settlement. The fact, there had been facts, I think, presented in support of the settlement. Whether those facts were sufficient is a different issue. But to say no facts was misdescribing the situation. The judge also spoke of a requirement for what he called, quote, legitimate facts. Another thing the judge stated was that preserving all of the citations as written had no value in the Secretary's future enforcement efforts. None of these expressions of opinion by the judge was necessary, and they invite allegations of error. Second, the judge larded up his two orders with words and phrases that at best can be described as injudicious. To take just one example, and there are dozens, the judge referred to the Secretary's contention that keeping the citations as written by the inspector would assist future enforcement efforts, that would assist future enforcement efforts. The judge called that, quote, pure blather. This kind of hyperbolic excess does not reflect well on the Commission and should not be indulged in by Commission judges. Our judges can express disagreement with the contentions of parties appearing before them without engaging in gratuitous insults. Moreover, these were the kinds of expressions which, if the case is referred at some point by a court of appeals, could well suggest to the appellate judges that the Commission's opinion is not worthy of respect. By using the inflammatory language, I think Judge Moran played into the hands of the Secretary's test case strategy. With respect to what the Commission should do with the appeals by the Secretary and American Coal, I'm inclined to do the following, and I stress the word inclined. First, I think we should address the points raised by the Secretary and American Coal. In particular, I would address the distinction made by American Coal between procedural facts, that is, facts related to the process by which the settlement was reached, and to non-monetary aspects of the settlement as a whole, and substantive facts, which is to say, facts relating to the citations themselves. In so doing, I would clarify that while procedural facts may be relevant and can be included in settlement motion, that the motion must also contain substantive facts relating to the particular citations. In this regard, I do not see any imposition on the parties by requiring that each citation be addressed with a brief statement of what was charged by the inspector, what the operator would say in response, whether there is any proposed change in negligence or gravity, whether the penalty which had been proposed is suggested to be changed, and if there's a change in the penalty, briefly, why. We should bear in mind that each citation was separately written by an inspector and separately assessed by MSHA's Office of Assessments, and that if the case goes to trial, each citation would have to be separately proven. The fact that there may be 32 citations being resolved in a single settlement should not change the requirements of substantive facts. And it seems to me that this is the practice our judges are following now. What was perhaps most striking in yesterday's oral argument was the discussion by counsel for the Secretary and American Coal about the practice followed by at least some of our judges, that when they are unsure about the facts of a citation, they contact or have their clerks contact the parties to get more information. Counsel for the appellants seemed to resent this practice, but I think it should be lauded and encouraged, unless it becomes excessive. And I understand that the Commission has pending before it a PIR in the Solar Sources case where the Secretary has alleged excessiveness on the part of Judge Moran. This is precisely what our judges should be doing in their evaluation of proposed settlements. Whatever we do in this case, we must not undercut the ability of Commission judges to review the factual basis for proposed settlements. A second point we should address is the ability of the parties to seek settlements with across-the-board reductions in penalties. I would personally prefer that across-the-board penalty reductions not be the norm, but there are times when they are necessary or desirable, and we've recognized that and should again continue to recognize that. The third point I think we should address is American Coal's point about Judge Moran's use of the phrase legitimate questions of fact. Like Mr. Hardin, I don't know what that phrase means. I think that our judges should be looking, what the judges should be looking at is actual questions of fact which arise in settlements without evaluating whether such questions are or are not legitimate. Second, I am inclined to agree with Sarah's memo that while the judge committed errors, ultimately he was correct that the Secretary failed to provide sufficient facts to enable a Commission judge to evaluate whether the settlement should be approved. I recognize that the judge did not address the standard we formulated in the first American Coal case. Proposed settlement, including the reduction in penalties, must be found to be fair, reasonable, appropriate under the facts, and protective of the public interest in mine safety. However, we have to recognize in this case that given the absence of substantive facts provided by the Secretary, Judge Moran was unable to address that issue. Third, in remanding the case to the judge, I would have the Commission insert a special proviso that given the possible confusion on issues like whether Rule 31B1 requires substantive facts or whether procedural facts are sufficient, that upon remand, the party should be given a period of time, such as 30 days, within which they can resubmit the settlement motion so as to include substantive facts. And here we might want to include language accepting Mr. Hardin's offer that the operator can submit facts if the Secretary refuses to do so. I'm making the suggestion that we explicitly provide for another opportunity to resubmit the motion for several reasons. One is that there might have been genuine confusion on what the Commission means by facts sufficient to justify a settlement. A second reason is that since American Coal showed good faith in making the offer to supply facts, I don't think it should be punished by foreclosing the possibility of settlement despite the Secretary's position. The third reason is that if this case should go up to the Court of Appeals in furtherance of the Secretary's desire to have a test case challenging the Commission's settlement approval authority, I want the record to show that we gave the Secretary every possible opportunity to provide facts sufficient to justify the proposed settlement. All that being said, I understand from conversations yesterday and from Commissioner Jordan's presentation that a majority of commissioners are inclined to find that Judge Moran committed reversible error and that they would vacate his order denying settlement and hopefully if they do that, remand the case back to him. But maybe there's a possibility of approving the settlement here. I cannot agree to approve the settlement here. I'll say that flat out. If we remand it back, I could possibly join that opinion if certain things are made clear in that opinion. First, to be approved, a settlement motion must include substantive facts about the citations in question. Second, that we approve the current practice of commission judges who, when they are not given sufficient facts in a settlement motion, contact the parties and seek additional facts. And three, that in this case we will give the Secretary and American Coal, together or individually, the opportunity to provide additional facts before the judge makes a decision on remand.
Thank you, Commissioner Cohen.
Thank you.
Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sarah, thank you very much for your excellent memo and analysis of this case. And I thank my colleagues also for their informative and well-reasoned presentations, much of which I agree with. In particular, I think Commissioner Jordan and I probably have the same view of the case. I'm not sure that our 110K authority is actually unique. I see a parallel here between what we do, what our commission judges do, rather, and what judges in criminal court, at least in some of the states where I've practiced or observed, do in evaluating plea agreements. Prosecutor has the discretion to compromise and enter into plea agreements with defendants, but in many jurisdictions, that's subject to being approved by or rejected by the judge, who may have some considerations. And in that arena in particular, it's a prosecutor is it's got to be very sensitive about giving up much information about the weakness of his case because he's already required to turn over all exculpatory evidence and you don't want to start giving a roadmap to the opposition. And I think there's a legitimate concern that the Secretary has here, particularly in the world we live in now, where you have much greater availability of information generally, in terms of access to it at the click of a button, literally. Much greater ability to process large amounts of data or to find correlative points in a data field, and a greater consolidation both in the mining industry and in the practice of law, engaged not only in mine safety law but health and safety law generally, so that you have larger firms with a greater degree of specialization. You combine those things, not an unfounded reluctance on the part of the Secretary to make too much information available, because not only does it perhaps prejudice your upcoming or impending trial of a case that might not settle if you don't accede to the demands of the judge, but also over the longer term and across the broader spectrum, the possibility that the Secretary's habits and proclivities might be broken down and analyzed by counsel for the operators. I have a lot of sympathy for the Secretary's position on not wanting to tip the hand, as Mr. Waldman said. I think that's a valid concern. At the same time, though, I agree completely with Commissioner Cohen that the the fact that judges and their clerks may be reaching out to parties and seeking additional information is an encouraging indication that they are living up to the responsibility conferred upon them by Section 110K of the Act. And I'm wholly in favor of noting that favorably in our decision. But I have a disagreement with Commissioner Cohen on one of the other points. I think the 30 days is a great idea, but I would not hold that a party or the parties or especially the Secretary must include substantive facts in any settlement. What I would be willing to say and what I would suggest we ought to say instead is that it is not error for a judge in the exercise of his discretion to determine in a given case that substantive facts are necessary. In this case, given the absolute dearth of substantive facts, the fact that I would agree with Judge Moran, this is not a global settlement. It's a large settlement of a large number relatively large number of citations, but this isn't the type of global settlement where you have multiple operations or a really large number of inspections and a voluminous number of citations, which might make the provision of substantive facts for each citation virtually impossible. And it might make the global settlement of cases so encumbered that it would become impractical. And the courts tend to view settlement properly as a social good. And I think that while we have the standard that we laid down in AMCOL 1, fair, reasonable, appropriate to the facts, and protective of the public interest, there's another principle we ought to consider here. And that's, first, do no harm. We have a system that is working, in the vast majority of cases, very well. The great, great bulk of citations and penalties are resolved without being contested, or are resolved and compromised without the need for a hearing. If it were otherwise, we'd be hamstrung and unable to perform our function. We need to look at this process and say, what's the success rate here? What is it? It's that close to perfection in terms of getting outcomes that are satisfactory to a commission judge. And with indications, as we heard yesterday, that the judges are taking this responsibility seriously. I don't want us to interfere too much with the proper exercise of judicial discretion. I think there were errors made in this case. I agree with the characterization of my colleagues in terms of what those errors were. I would say in the decision that it was error for the judge to refuse to consider information that would be relevant to the disposition and to his consideration of the settlement. I think that is a in this case a prejudicial error. I don't think it's a reversible error. I think it's something that causes us to vacate what the judge did and give him another opportunity. And it's hard for me to say that because this is a 2011 document. I mean, this case, it's been up here on interlock twice. Now, the Secretary's got his teeth into a concept. I have some concerns. They don't always pick the best test cases. And I have some further concerns in that, the idea that there's no need for us to really have a genuine review of settlements. I have seen, we've had cases come here where it appeared to me that the Secretary was compromising a case where it had basically won already. We've had a case where they settled a case out from under a minor in a 105C case, and without the minor's consent or knowledge, and we had to undo that. It's something we have to remember is that as close to perfection as you might get or want to be, You know, these things are executed by and agreed to and negotiated by fallible people and review to ensure that the act's intents and purposes are upheld is an important part of diminishing the possibility that the protections and safeguards required by the act don't have an unintended and disastrous consequence at some point. So I think it's really important to preserve the discretionary authority of our judges and to reinforce that in what we do in this case and in future cases with a mind towards what was said at the beginning yesterday. We have this perhaps tension or perhaps a need for accommodation between confidence and humility. And we should be confident in our ability to do our job and that our system is working well because the data indicate that. But we should also recognize that each of us, individual commissioners, judges, the solicitor's office, has a role to play and be respectful of the other people and their roles and their contributions and their dedication to what we're trying to achieve here. I think I'm inclined to agree with my colleagues that this should be remanded to the judge and that we should give him instruction that it was error not to consider the so-called procedural facts, but that it was not error for him to require substantive facts if he can explain why it is necessary. And you know, the less substantive facts you have, the easier it might be to do. If you don't have any, you say, it's really hard for me to evaluate how this is in the public interest because I don't know really what you're giving up. But I think he should also be required to at least consider and to make a determination as to whether it's relevant, such information as the operator may provide on the facts. I don't think the information needs to come from the secretary. And in fact, if the operator is going to make this submission that says, this is what we think is the strength of our case, the judge could look at that and say, okay, this gives me some understanding of why you might not want to try this case or on these particular citations. I haven't seen that submission or reviewed it. That's something that the judge should do on remand. But I think that we need to preserve the authority of our judges to look at this. But I would not say that as a bright line rule that they have to include substantive facts. I think that's a requirement that is going to vary based on the amount of the reduction, the number of citations involved, the things that may be apparent from circumstances. You talked about the Aracoma case yesterday. And I would rather reserve that to the judge's discretion, but point out that it is not an error for the judge to require such facts where he can explain why they would be necessary to his consideration of the settlement in this case. I think it's important for us to note in the decision that the as written, while now apparently moot, is really an important thing. I don't know how many times early, it used to happen a lot earlier, but you go over to the oral arguments at the D.C. Circuit and they'd just be scratching their head, why are we here on a $200 penalty? The reason is as written. The as written was a problem for the operator. The principle is a problem. Getting an operator to accept paper as written has had some value in this case. It may be considerable value. And I think that some further explanation or elaboration on that by the secretary may be useful and might be conclusive or persuasive to the judge. I don't know, but I think it's something that really needs to be considered. And I don't think that's something that should be dismissed out of hand. It's an important thing. So with that said, I generally agree with my two colleagues that I remand this case to the judge. With some guidance on how to apply the standard that we set down in the first decision in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Young. I really appreciate all the comments by my colleagues, and I'll be a little disjointed because you've raised such good points, and I don't have a particularly planned presentation. I'll maybe skip around and hit some of your points. I'll start with a complete agreement with Commissioner Young's point that this is a system that we're working, that's working well now. And we shouldn't say anything, this opinion, that, in a sense, disrupts a working system. I think it's relevant, in light of Commissioner Cohen's remarks about Judge Moran's language here, is that of the 30 or so motions to to settle that have been denied in the last 3.5 years, Judge Moran has issued 26 of them. So this, in some sense, is a problem with between the secretary and one judge. The other judges have somehow worked this out. Now, Commissioner Cohen says, and we have this Rassler memo, maybe the secretary has declared war on us, and this is seen by the secretary as some sort of turf war. I think it's foolish for us to think of it as a turf war. I'm not at war with the secretary. They have very legitimate objectives in settling cases. So I don't think if this is a turf war, and we were talking about World War One yesterday, I don't think we want to get our back up and say we're going to go to war and put lots of hard-hitting stuff in this opinion so that we are winning this war, so our guys have the power. We have the power. You don't have – that's not going to get anybody anywhere. So my opinion – so I think this should be a – well, actually, I'm going to say that I completely agree with Commissioner Jordan's opening statement that we should vacate. I'm inclined to just go ahead and approve the settlement. Now, why would I be inclined to do that? Because you've raised good points about why we shouldn't do that. I thought the AMCOL's brief, where they set out these points that Commissioner Cohen went through, and I think Sarah went through at the beginning, where the internal, they've said, and I don't know how a judge doesn't take the secretary's counsel at their word when they say they've done something. We're not going to start the depositions of secretaries. Do you really believe this? So they said the internal analysis conducted by the secretary's counsel of violations, inspector's notes, and district views in the AMCOL's position statement. Substantial risks of reductions to gravity and negligence of 14 of the 32 violations. The risk of vacatur of one additional citation. An estimated outcome, if everything's adverse, of 50%. The prosecutorial impact of settling the case and litigating others. The significant advantage of preserving all violations as written as part of the settlement. And the potential negative impact on the secretary's ability to effectively and efficiently enforce the active reallocation of penalty amounts on a citation-by-citation basis is required. If you had to do that on a citation-by-citation basis, it would be a nightmare for an across-the-board. We have one from, some of them are in the hundreds. Judge Feldman had one in December. It was 52 citations. So I don't know what the workload of solicitor's counsel is out there. But I don't think we just say, the fact that they are busy people is completely irrelevant to this discussion. So where am I going with this? Why would I approve this? This case involves 32 citations issued 8 years ago with now a proposed reduction of $13,000. It's a peanuts case, and it's 8 years old. There's a question whether we should send this back to Judge Moran. His indicated strength of feeling on this, to me, raises the question, can he fairly adjudicate this case anymore? I don't think they've asked to not have it sent back to him. They've asked for approval of settlement. I think that's a question we have to deal with. I think we avoid that question, and properly so. I know this may not be a good reason for approving the settlement in some person's eyes. We avoid that if we approve the settlement, which is actually, it's $13,000. What would we, suppose it's 15%. Suppose they renegotiate 15%. That'd be $6,000 on citations that are 8 years old. I don't see this as a matter of, as I said, I don't think our opinion should set out any overwhelming principles that change the law significantly. I just don't see the need for that when Commissioner Young says it's working. Do our judges have a right, in fact, beyond a right, a duty to assure settlements are fair, reasonable? Yes, they have that right and that duty. Does that mean they should ask questions when they want to? Absolutely. And in any opinion we write, we should make that absolutely clear, that they have the right to go back. But I think about this sort of the bigger question here that Mr. Waldman alluded to yesterday, that, you know, the secretary's counsel, he didn't say it quite this way, are busy people, and these questions, these constant questions are driving them nuts. I can understand that. I mean, I can understand that. And I understand that our caseload is down and we have law clerks and the law clerks need something to do. And one good way to have something to do is to question every settlement and call out. I'm constantly calling, hey, judge, maybe I should call. I think this is a human dynamic that has no easy answer. But to me, the easy answer is the system is working. Settlements are happening. Judges are making the calls. And that should continue as is without anything written in this decision that would indicate to our judges that there's some need for a fundamental change in the way we process settlements. The settlement system is working. There is not a need for a fundamental change in the way we process settlements. So I think because this case is so old, it should be ended. It's time for a peanuts case to be ended. If it went to 15%, it would be $6,000. We're really going to continue this 8-year-old case because it might get the $6,000, or that there would be a 5-day trial for 32 citations because we're unwilling to settle this amount. To me, it's crazy not to settle this case. In fact, that's another point. We know it will get settled on remand. The facts will come in, and it will get settled. And it will get settled for this amount, 30%. Why delay the inevitable over a nothing case and where we might inadvertently, in opinion, establish principles that are far too overreaching for what's necessary here. They said this is a solution looking for a problem. Let's not take a little case and make it into a bigger problem. So I would write an opinion that would trace Commissioner Jordan's points, all our points, on the legal errors made by the judge. The judge made these legal errors. And say that given the 8 years, given the amount of money involved, given the propositions made by the Secretary's counsel, we approve the settlement. No, that's what I would do. No, Commissioner.
Commissioner, I want to respond to that. To approve the settlement at this point is to reward the Secretary's strategy in this case. I'm sorry.
Okay. So what?
So what? Well,
that's what I'm saying. Let's be big boys about it. They put a lot in. The case is a nothing case. It's been here for 8 years. Let's get rid of it and not say anything sweeping. This is not a contest of wills between us and the Secretary. This is just a legal case to be resolved by intelligent adult human beings.
No one's talking about saying anything sweeping, I don't think.
Well, if you say you have to be substantive and facts, we have to address all the citations and give facts and so on. So, yeah. No, we shouldn't say that. That would tend to destroy a system that's working. Let's not destroy a system.
Actually, that would tend to confirm the system that's working.
All right.
Because that's what goes on in the case.
And I would.
Case. These settlements do not submit specific facts on when they're putting in 52 citations to be settled in one fell swoop. They're not. I don't think. I don't know. I'm not in the judge's
office.
That's the
point. We don't really know what's going on. I know you were making that point yesterday with the counsel, with the secretary, but that why are you complaining? You're already doing this. It's working. To be honest, I, like counsel for the union, was heartened to hear the examples, the operator kind of putting forth some of the examples where the judges have asked for more facts. But in reality, there could be 95% of those motions to settle submitted that are boilerplate without any information and being approved. We don't get behind them. We don't know them, and in point of fact, if they're approved, even on a standard that we might think was skimpy, and maybe they're not really, doing a whole lot to really reassure themselves and a whole lot of oversight, those cases would tend not to come up. We wouldn't know it. The union is not involved in the settlement negotiations for the most part, and, I'm not even sure. I mean, it'd be an interesting legal question if it was approved. Would they alone be able to appeal from an approval? But so we can say it's working, but I'm not sure what that means. It's working that we're not getting a lot of complaints and most of them are settled. And I feel good about the information that came out yesterday, and I believe the judges I am reassured that the judges are taking that responsibility seriously. I had sort of the thought process that you just went through, too. I mean, when I first looked at Sarah's memo and saw it was suggesting a remand, albeit for a different reason, I was like, are you kidding me? There's no way I can even wrap my head around continuing this torturous path, you know, putting this case like back in a remand. But the more I thought about it, I thought that would be the appropriate path, you know, because I felt the judge should have considered certain information. And I guess, you know, I wasn't totally comfortable with just saying, all right, you know, we'll just take it and approve it as it is. We, you know, we don't have any substantive facts. The judge wanted substantive. They were offering facts. It's best to remand it. I did also consider whether it should be remanded to a different judge, because the secretary did ask for that relief. And I was kind of wondering, I mean, because I do feel like there was an aspect to the judge's decision that, you know, he, you know, had a certain tone that could be problematic, but, and also distracting, you know, from his legal analysis. But they didn't raise that in the argument yesterday. They didn't even address that point. So I'm going to take
it. They were asking for approval of the settlement, weren't they, really?
They were asking for approval of the settlement, but...
They didn't say, for God's sakes, if you just remand it, don't send it to Judge Moran. That's true.
Well, they said in their brief, and they didn't, you know, they didn't refer to it. So I feel like, okay, you know, that's not, in other words, you raise that as a point where in favor of approving it.
Yeah,
because we wouldn't have to deal with that legal question. And I'm saying, like,
I'm going to
treat it as, you know, almost waived. I mean, they didn't develop it. They didn't develop it much in the brief. They didn't develop an argument. And so, yes, I'm going to conclude that the remand is appropriate and back to Judge Moran.
Well, I'm taking you at your word that that's your position, and I'll go along with a remand back to Judge Moran, although I'd prefer to just swat this fly now.
Yeah.
But what I will hope is the decision is nearly crafted to his legal heirs and that he should look at it and not get into grand sweeping statements about what must be done in settlement situations.
No, I agree, simply for the fact of trying to get the opinion out somewhat expeditiously. The more we go off into a grand statement of what must be in settlements.
I think we might as well be honest with that. I mean, in 2011, I think it was, the average judge disposed of 850 cases. They were not checking into settlements real carefully in those days. Sometimes the degree of checking into things depends upon the amount of time you've got to check into things. And so I think our judges do need to make sure that settlements are fair, reasonable, and serve the public interest. And we should say that again and again and again, because that's the cardinal, that's the fundamental principle. But as to the vigor with which they question things, that's probably a little bit of a movable feast, depending on how busy they are, too. So they should challenge it. They have the right to do it. I would not encumber that in any way. But I still think, you know, and I'd encourage the secretary to recognize this is an obligation of the judges, and they have to comply with it. And just, I was going to say man up, but I guess I have to say person up, and do the things you need to do.
Okay, I think we have an empiric question here.
Empiric?
Empiric question that we can actually investigate. My review of settlements is that they seem to, settlement decisions by our judges, is that they seem to typically say, this is what the secretary said, this is what the operator said, we're going to do thus and so. We're going to cut negligence from high to moderate, whatever they do. But they put a little statement of what the contentions are. which is not the same thing, by the way, as making the secretary reveal any trial strategy or saying this case is weak. And that, I mean, I think that's a red flag, and they may have done it on purpose.
I agree.
But just a simple statement of that. Now, I think we could probably create a system where we look at, in some random fashion, 100 or so recent settlements and see what the judges have put in them. And if they're not putting in brief statement of facts, then I stand corrected. If they are, then I think maybe we should, my colleagues should rethink the way they're looking at what's required in the settlement. I don't want to undercut
absolutely
what the judges are presently doing, and there is a strategy on the part of the secretary to give us as little as they possibly can get away with, and hopefully nothing if they win on appeal. And to say that here does not mean that we say it in an opinion. I'm not suggesting we put that in an opinion. I'm simply suggesting we recognize it. And as it happens, we are a remarkably open and transparent agency, so these things get said here.
If that's the secretary's strategy, then what will happen, regardless what happens in this case, there will be a case sometime in a relatively near future that where the judge asks for information, the clerk asks for information, and the solicitor says, no, you don't need it, we're not going to give it to you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That will become a test case.
Well, that will be the next level test case.
That would be a clear-cut test case. I don't think this is a clear-cut test case at this point, and it's just not worth going to war.
This is
World War I, man. This is a useless war. This is a war in which
you get them to stop.
That's what the Kaiser said. Excuse me. I'm sorry. That's what the King said. That's what they all said. Get them to stop. You know, sort of like I was thinking.
You could analogize to World War I. We could also analogize to World War II and suggest it's not time for Munich.
I was even thinking to make it more homely on the way in. I was thinking more of it as a spousal situation. How many times one spouse says to the other, at least in my marriage, can't you do that? And can't you do that? You know,
I would agree with you. When I asked Mr. Waldman yesterday, he said, oh, we're not questioning the first decision. I said, well, you know, you're not questioning because it's law of the case, and you're preserving your right to, you know, to question it in the future. Yes, he acknowledged that candidly. So, you know, I don't see any retraction of Heidi Strassler's memo.
Why do we care if they retract it? Why do we care what position
they don't have to retract it. We have to stop it.
No, we don't. They have a right to take their position and to litigate it and see if a court would agree with it.
That's right. They have a right to take their position, but we don't have to be stupid and roll over and let them get away with it.
We affirm the right of our judges.
But if you do, and I might well join.
We did that in AMCO 1, and I would tend to agree with the chairman. Look, let's just go back to what we said and said, this is what we said, and apply it to this case and resolve it that way. I mean,
we may well be able to do that, Mike. If we were to approve the settlement, can you?
Yeah, no, I said I'd approve it.
You said you'd approve it, so maybe that's not on the table anymore.
Well, they've taken it off. I've never convinced the two of them to change your mind about anything, so I don't put them changing. Yeah. They're not changing their mind, so we're not going to approve the settlement. Approve the settlement. I mean,
I think approval of the settlement would be inconsistent with what we said in AMCO 1. And this is not a nothing case for the same reason that the $200 penalty case at the D.C. Circuit is not a nothing case. People don't go to war over nothing.
Sometimes they do.
They go to war over something that in hindsight turns out to have been maybe insufficient justification for the war, but they don't go to war without them feeling in the moment that this is worth fighting over. and contest.
Well, as long as we preserve the judges.
This is not war. Let's be clear.
No, this is not like war.
This is a reasonable and civil disagreement over a very fine point of obscure law.
We don't even know what's in this area. They could just be saying, we're sick of Judge Moran denying motions to settle. We would have to go after that guy somehow. We don't know what's in the secretary's mind. We say secretary, never heard of us. But whoever's running the office of the solicitor over there that deals with us, we don't know really what's in the mind of that. I don't even know who it is. It's not Heidi anymore. Who is it?
Oh.
Is Ollie running the office? Yeah. He seems like a pretty reasonable guy to me.
Maybe.
Shaking hands with him. That's all you know.
But I mean, the judges are not going to roll over, and so they're going to rule. They're going to get what they need for settlement, and the secretary can take it. I was like, I don't get upset about it because I feel like you can make all the argument you want, but ultimately, you got to get the judge to approve it. And
what I don't want to do is suggest to the judges that they somehow at this point have failed in their responsibility. I think we're affirming that they have succeeded in a responsibility by asking questions.
Well, that's a key word, responsibility, because with the power comes the responsibility, and the judges have to articulate why they've made a decision. It has to be reasonable. That we have to be able to understand it. That's why the inflammatory language is bad, because it tends to give a cast of, I'm not making this decision based on my review of this. That's why one of the problems I have with this decision is, while we said, look, across the board settlements, there's nothing per se wrong with that. When you reduce it to something where he seems to suggest this is incapable of the kind of mathematical precision where you would magically get this 30% number in every one of these cases, he's basically saying, no, I don't believe in it. I don't agree with you, Commission.
Right.
That's a problem. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, settling cases is hard. You know that. I mean, going through that process, it's not something where it's susceptible to the kind of precision that you can get in a video simulation or a computer simulation of something. It's two people subjectively trying to guess what might happen if they don't agree to it. And you have people who might be stronger or weaker in a given situation, and they might make better or worse decisions. You have people with better or worse facts. All of these are, there's too many variables. And this is not chemistry. This is economics.
If I may suggest, because we eventually will need to get to it, for Sarah's benefit, I'll throw out a suggestion, and then you can shoot at it. That Sarah craft a you always say narrowly draft, a decision based upon the legal errors outlined by Commissioner Jordan. And then in that decision, we reaffirm, approve the not only the right, but the duty of the judges to satisfy themselves that settlements are fair, reasonable, and in the public interest, and that we not question that right whatsoever, and that we're sending this back. And I agree with the 30 days. I think we talked about it before. I agree with the idea that the judge should give them another opportunity. If they don't want to take the opportunity, if the secretary really wants to make this a test and say, no, we've said enough, we're not going to say anything more, so be it. Then the judge will rule on that. If they put something more in, he can rule on that. But just give them the opportunity and let the chips fall where they may.
I second that.
Is there any objection to the suggestion that we survey 100 cases?
I strongly object.
No.
I'm not going to strongly object, but I'm going to say if you want to put forward a proposal for that so we can consider it and respond to the proposal, I'm not going to say yes or no today, though.
Can
I list my objection?
Sure.
One, how many thousands of settlements happen each year? How do we pick the 100 in some legitimate?
We could ask Colin to pick it.
Okay.
Which judges?
How many settlements? So even legitimately, like as a valid representation, I would have concern. Second, why are we looking at things that are not in the? I mean, there's these other settlements, and no party has directed us to it. Do the other people get to respond? The parties in the case about, no, these are not representative, or why you should not take these, what weight you should give them. And three, we've all conceded this case. It needs to be resolved quickly,
He's not talking about any relation to this case. He's talking about a side.
Am I wrong about that?
Were you saying before we issued a decision?
Yeah, I thought before we issued the decision.
I'm not in favor of that at all.
The,
You want to do this as a side project?
Oh, yeah.
The purpose of this.
Carter's got time.
The purpose of this is to test.
And so does Roy. Roy's got time.
We've got a disagreement here as to what the practice is. And the practice in terms of whether they require...
We have a case. We have a case in front of us.
Well, we want to defend what the... We want to defend the judge's practice, but we don't know what the judge's practice
is. I don't want to defend the judge's practice. I want to make sure that the process works and that the judge defends his own practice. And under the legal principles we set out there, in this case... Because that's what we're deciding.
If we were trying to do this before we issued a decision, this case will be gone before the decision was issued anyway.
So. That's why I was objecting, big part of it, yeah.
I don't think it's a bad idea to take a look at that as an outside, separate project that we could have somebody work on. It might have some value to the commission. All I said was, put a proposal together and we'll consider it, but I'm not going to agree to do something in connection with this case. I don't think it's necessary and I don't think it's a good idea. But it may be a good idea to do that outside of the boundaries of deciding this case.
Well, okay. Sorry. 3-1 on that proposal. Anything else that Sarah needs to know? Everybody ready to leave? Okay, we'll go off the record.